Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 27th of March 2020, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me in the studio today, Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire. Welcome to the programme, Patrick.
Great to be with you, Mike.
So let's get straight on with it, Patrick. The latest statistics. So the number of COVID-19 cases now up to 549,576. 24,887 people have passed away globally. And 128,701 recoveries so far. So that leaves us with 395,988 active cases. 374,951 of those are classed as mild, and 21,037 are classed as serious or critical. So that's where we are with that. Now, Boris Johnson put out a little video clip this morning. He says that he is now tested positive for coronavirus because he received the test because he has a temperature and he says a persistent cough. So let's just have a brief listen to what he had to say.
Hi folks, I want to bring you up to speed with something that's happening today, which is that I've developed mild symptoms of the coronavirus, that's to say a temperature and a persistent cough. And on the advice of the chief medical officer, I've taken a test that has come out positive. So I am working from home. I'm self-isolating. And that's entirely the right thing to do. But be in no doubt that I can continue, thanks to the wizardry of modern technology, to communicate with all my top team to lead the national fight back against coronavirus. And I want to thank everybody who's involved. I want to thank, of course, above all, our amazing NHS staff. It was very moving last night to join in that national clap for the NHS. But it's not just the...
So that's what Boris had to say this morning, Patrick. But in the meantime, on Wednesday evening, British democracy effectively suspended because that was the breakup of Parliament. A few days early for the Easter break. Parliament will not come back for a month now. And the question is whether Parliament is going to come back in this form at all, because one of the things that was being discussed was the need to create a virtual Parliament, virtual select committees. Now, it's not clear what any of this means, how is it going to work, and what public scrutiny is going to be available for this. But the Speaker saying that they needed to get licensing in place for a security platform that Number 10 currently has at the moment, but they are going to hopefully roll that out, he says, to the rest of Parliament. So that's where we are with that. No opposition in Parliament to really offer scrutiny into what the government is doing at the moment.
So when will Parliament reconvene, Mike, or when is it meant to reconvene?
Well, at the moment it's a month. But that's not clear, as I say, whether it reconvenes after a month in a physical form or in a virtual form.
Because of fears of the contagion, right, within the legislature and so forth.
But it's not just the UK that we're suspending democracy.
No, it isn't. And this isn't a new article per se, but you can see this talking point was being circulated as this crisis began to take hold in the West. This is Foreign Policy Magazine. It's time to cancel the U.S. presidential campaign as we know it. And they're talking about doing away with in-person voting and also select committees and government special bodies that meet in person, Mike, because of fears of the deadly virus. They're saying it's too much of a gamble for elected officials to come together and to do things together, to debate together, to meet together, and so forth. So, you know, this has really wide-ranging implications. Mm-hmm. I don't think people have quite come to grips with. And I think you could have a situation, Mike, where you have a constitutional crisis brewing in a number of countries because of this.
Now, what's going on in the United States, then, Patrick, with respect to bailout?
Well, this is very interesting, and it's very connected to what we just spoke about as well. But the House leaders seek to expedite the emergency aid package. This passed through the Senate, Mike, on Wednesday, but it's still waiting to be passed through the House. And just for those out there, that's a $2 trillion relief bill, $2 trillion of relief. This is really largely a bailout as well. But there's a lot of other things that have been piled into this gigantic bill. And so let's look at what they're saying here. Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy have agreed to approve the measure with a voice vote on Friday. And they also said, this is the interesting part, they will not require all 430 current members of the House to travel to the Capitol, given that two lawmakers have tested positive for the disease. And others are self-quarantining due to exposure to confirmed carriers. But here's the interesting part. The leadership also is taking meticulous steps to change the protocol for debate and voting to ensure the safety of lawmakers, Mike.
So are we talking about a virtual Congress then?
Yes, we are. We're talking about virtual government. And I don't think this is going to be confined to this legislature. This would probably be across the board, and including the judiciary branch as well.
Okay, so the U.S. has its own emergency legislation. Now, of course, Parliament did not close on Wednesday without having passed the coronavirus bill that we've been talking about on the last couple of news programs. So that has received royal assent and is now the Coronavirus Act. What sort of things are we seeing as a result of that? Emergency laws to take effect within hours after the final passing hurdle.
That's right. So this is the bill, let's just call it that, no pun intended with the image there with the Daily Mirror. But so this comes into effect, Mike, and raises some interesting points. And one of the persons who have raised one of the most important fundamental points here is Lord Newby. He is the Liberal Democrat leader in the UK's House of Lords. And this is what he had to say. He says, as in wartime, we will have to change the way we do things. And when it's all over, things will not revert to business as usual. That's important. I am sure that everyone wishes the government well as it grapples with the coronavirus. But democracies can never give the executive a blank check.
But in fact, that's what we have done by closing Parliament. We've effectively given the executive a blank check to do as they wish. With no major opposition.
And in the UK, but also in the United States, the same issue, Mike. It's the same fundamental principle because, and this is a really important point, okay? In a democracy, the legislature is representing the population, and they vote on things like spending. The power of the purse is the most important really aspect of the functioning of government and the state, okay? So you have limited resources, and governments make this call every day, whether it's in the NHS, whether it's in the military, the police, law enforcement programs. They have to allocate resources according to the severity of various threats. In a democracy, this has always been the case since the beginning of democracies. Mm. But if it's a fascist dictatorship or a monarchy or a banana republic, those rules don't apply. You can basically spend all of you want and have golden taps on your faucets and throw whatever amount of money you want at any particular problem with no accountability or real public oversight or debate or quorum. Okay, so, and this is the dichotomy of the situation we find ourselves in now. Are we really a democracy if there's no accountability on spending?
Well, indeed, that's a very good question. But in the UK, then, we've got the Coronavirus Act passed. That's primary legislation. It's an act of Parliament. Everybody is aware of that. But there's secondary legislation at work here as well. So there've been a few what are known as statutory instruments passed. Another place we need to be looking at is orders of the Privy Council. So people need to be watching those very carefully as well. But in the meantime, I want to highlight this one. This is the Health Protection Coronavirus Restrictions Wales Regulations 2020. So this is some secondary legislation. It is a statutory instrument. And it is this that's being used to justify imposing a restriction on people's access to national parks, to national park authorities and resources. So Regulation 9 of this particular statutory instrument imposes a requirement on local authorities, national park authorities, Natural Resources Wales and the National Trust to close certain public paths and land accessible by the public. Now, this has been hitting the headlines over the last couple of days as the police are restricting access, apparently, to some of this public land. But in fact, it doesn't just sit with Wales, because here is Derbyshire Police, who pushed this out this morning on Twitter. And on the Twitter post, they said, despite posts yesterday highlighting issues of people still visiting the Peak District in Derbyshire, despite government guidance, keyword guidance, the message is still not getting through. So the Derbyshire Police drone unit has been out at beauty spots across the county, and this footage was captured at Kerber Edge last night. So they are saying that what these people are doing is not essential, that they shouldn't be doing it. But here's the issue, Patrick. In the Wales, then we have the situation where there's a statutory instrument in place which theoretically gives legal basis for a restriction of access to certain public areas. There is no such legislation in England. In fact, certain law firms and lawyers are now speaking out against Derbyshire Police here for this. They're saying that there is no legal basis for this video or for this attitude towards what's going on. And what seems to be happening here, Patrick, is that the police are acting beyond their authority. They have no authority to restrict access to these places. And bearing in mind that the message from Boris over the last couple of weeks is that people are free to go out individually and exercise, and including in parks within the towns and cities. And yet the police are attempting to prevent people from going to the Peak District, where people are unlikely to meet anybody, at any particular time. So this has no basis in law. We're seeing the police acting beyond their authority. And what this looks like to me is some policemen rubbing their hands together, saying, excellent, we can now play with our new toys, in this case a drone, and they're following people around with the drone and videoing them from height.
One of the most shocking things about this, Mike, is the cynicism in the language used by the police. They're basically shaming people for taking phone pictures with their phones and Instagram snaps, they called it, and also really kind of ribbing the public, making fun of them, shaming them, and so forth. And is that going a step far by the police? Is that within the remit? I think what you'll find, Mike, is you've just identified a situation where there's law, there's centralized policy, but all the different agencies around are doing their own thing, making it up as they go along,
absolutely,
interpreting it the way that they think is fit, and then trying to enforce things on a sort of local basis. So this, the soil is fertile for any number of the human impulse. There would be the petty tyrant.
Right.
This is the danger of this sort of climate right now, is that there is coherence in terms of the legal side of things. So we'll keep an eye very closely on this issue.
Absolutely. So maybe David Gawke gives the game away. David Gawke, MP, saying that Derbyshire Police's activities here badly misjudged. Doesn't mention the fact that what they're doing is illegal, but badly misjudged. People should maintain social distancing, which is what these people in the video clip are doing. We need to maintain public support for fundamental behaviour change, which requires the authorities to focus on genuinely bad behaviour. And I think what he's doing here is putting his finger on what this is all about. This is about behavioural change in society. Well, what more can we say about that? Badly misjudged doesn't go far enough. Now, moving on then, let's look at the latest figures from Momo, Euromomo, which is the website that we mentioned on Wednesday, which is highlighting excess mortality in many countries around Europe, all European countries, really, certainly most of them. The details can be found at euromomo.eu if anybody wants to look at that. And we're mentioning this because they've updated this now to week 12 on Wednesday. We only had the information up until week 11. So this takes us up until the 22nd of March. This first graph here is showing the pooled number of deaths. So this is a picture of the entire European continent. And what we can see, Patrick, is here for week 12. In fact, the mortality rate is well below the average for this time of year in all age groups. We've got to ask the question, and we're just asking the question, why are we seeing this this response, political response to this event, when what we seem to be seeing from the figures, from the data, is that mortality, there's nothing unusual about the mortality rates that we're seeing compared to what we would expect at this time of year.
So looking at this data quickly, Mike, there are previous months in previous years where there's a much larger spike in excess death, right? And a number of data points, correct?
Absolutely.
But that's not happening in the
not at this time.
In 2020 so far.
And if we look at the UK figures then, we can see that it's not happening here either. So this is for England, Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales. And each of those four cases, the mortality is below the average, which would be expected at this time of year. So this was the situation right across Europe. The only country which is really an outlier where the situation was any different for week 22 is, or sorry, for week 12, which is ending the 22nd of March, is Italy. Mm-hmm. So the question is, we covered some reasons why that might be on Wednesday programme, the relatively old population, also the relatively high smog problem that Italy has compared to other European countries. But perhaps this also gives us a clue, because actually Italy had a pretty vicious flu outbreak earlier in the year. So perhaps people were already immunocompromised as a result of that.
And this is late 2019 into early 2020, is that correct?
That's right. So this was since the start of the flu season, according to the local here, which is an Italian local publication. Since the start of the flu season in October 2019, 2.7 million cases across Italy were confirmed by laboratory tests, according to data from InfluNet, and that was published on January 19. And a total of 488,000 cases were reported in just 1 week in January, right?
Now compare those numbers to the coronavirus numbers, Mike, and they're substantial, aren't they?
They're extremely substantial, but the reason I'm mentioning that is just to suggest and ask the question, is Italy an outlier because Italy had this problem earlier in the year? Others didn't seem to have quite as severe a problem. Now,
and I might add just before, Mike, is that Italy has one of the oldest populations in Europe. This is a known fact. Statistically, you can go ahead and check that for yourself. But also, Northern Italy, respiratory sickness and illness, and cardiopulmonary complications, it's notorious for this as well. And a lot of that, Mike, has to do with the fact that there is a very old population there, and those two things naturally correlate. And this is what other experts said, like the ones that you identified on Wednesday's broadcast.
Right. So, you know, some people suggesting that we're arguing that, in fact, nothing should be done and people should just be allowed to die. Well, of course, this is not the case at all. What we're doing is asking questions about why we're seeing the political response to this particular event when the data does not seem to support the necessity of that response. And we're going to come on to more of that now, Patrick, because experts continue to disagree on this lockdown.
That's right, Mike. That's right. And this is the latest article. This was actually in the Wall Street Journal in the op-ed section. And is the coronavirus as deadly as they say? And let's take a look at what these two authors had to say about this. These are two Stanford professors of medicine, one of the top medical schools in the United States, and this is what they had to say here. If it's true that the novel coronavirus would kill millions without shelter-in-place orders and quarantines, then the extraordinary measures being carried out in cities and states around the country are surely justified. But there's little evidence to confirm that premise. The projections of the death toll could plausibly be orders of magnitude too high, say these two eminent doctors of medicine in the United States. But they go on, Mike, and this is what they had to say to carry on this point. Fear of COVID-19 is based on its high estimated case fatality rate. 2% to 4% of people who confirmed COVID-19 have died, according to the World Health Organization and others. So, they said, if 100 million Americans ultimately get the disease or test positive or have it, 2 million to 4 million could die. We believe that estimate is deeply flawed. The true fatality rate is the portion of those infected who die, not the deaths from identified positive cases. That's a very important point, Mike. And I think they also, just to carry on, and finally, if the numbers of actual infections is much larger than the number of cases, orders of magnitude larger, then the true fatality rate is much lower as well. That's not only plausible, but likely based on what we know so far. So, Mike, that really reflects the analysis that you've been given in the last couple of broadcasts here on the UK column, Mike. So that the data that's been used to ramp up sweeping policy just doesn't really it doesn't really represent the true picture in terms of the case fatality rate, the death rate, the mortality rate. And this is what these two eminent doctors of medicine in the United States at Stanford University have pointed out just this week.
Okay, so let's look at a few more of these. First of all, here's Professor Dr. Stefan Hockert, who in this video, it's not in English, it's in German, but in this video he says that COVID-19 is no more dangerous than influenza, but it's being observed much more closely. He said more dangerous than the virus is the fear and panic created by the media and the authoritarian reaction of government. So this is another voice with that particular story. And then here we have an Argentinian virologist and biochemist, Pablo Goldschmidt, and he's saying that COVID-19 no more dangerous than a bad cold or the flu. And he's saying that it's possible that this circulated already in previous years, but wasn't discovered because no one was looking for it. Then we have Professor Martin Exner, who's head of the Institute for Hygiene at the University of Bonn. And he's saying in this report here that while he's talking about why health personnel are currently under pressure, even though there hasn't been an increase in the number of patients in Germany so far. And he's saying that basically doctors and nurses who've tested positive have had to quarantine. Now, this leads into what Brian was talking about on Wednesday, because, of course, the UK also thinks it's very important to know how many doctors and nurses in the UK have this, because obviously they will need to be quarantined, and that then informs how capable the NHS is to deal with whatever comes in the coming weeks. But as Brian mentioned on Wednesday, the NHS doesn't seem to be counting these figures, or certainly there's no statistics available for that. But Martin Exner went on to say that nurses from neighbouring countries who provide an important part of care aren't able to enter the country. And of course, this puts more pressure on health systems as well. Then who's next? This is Professor Julian Nieder-Rumelin, former German Minister of State for Culture and Professor of Ethics. He's saying that COVID-19 is not posing any risk to healthy general population, and then therefore the curfews, the quarantine is an overreaction, not justified. Then we have a report from Japan here. This is using data from the Diamond Princess, one of the cruise ships, showing that all the test positive passengers, and despite the high average age, 48% remained completely symptom-free. And that was even amongst the 80 to 89-year-olds, 48% remained symptom-free, whilst amongst the 70 to 79-year-olds, it was 60% that were remaining symptom-free. So that's a little caption of what was going on one of the cruise ships. So if that's the case, then how does that apply to the rest of the general population in a country?
That's a good point, Mike. And we've also found that in the case of Italy, according to the data released by the Italian Health Institute last week, that there were a number of the fatalities were adults in palliative care. And palliative care means end-of-life care. And so they are highly vulnerable to things like not just COVID-19, Mike, but MRSA. And superbugs, antibiotic-resistant bugs. This is also a major epidemic in Italy as well. We can go through some of those numbers in the next program, perhaps, Mike. But that just to say that is a huge risk generally worldwide. these sort of too vulnerable demographics, Mike. So,
yes.
So then the question is, should governments be focusing their resources on protecting that vulnerable demographic and also ramping up treatment and looking for the best possible combinations of treatment? And this is what the Chinese have been putting out and saying quite loudly, is that we have found some successful combinations of treatment. This has been working. We think you should consider, because we've had some success in terms of focus our resources on treatment. So it's different approaches to this problem. And the point here, Mike, and I won't belabor this, but if you get the approach to the problem wrong, the consequences could be disastrous in terms of collateral damage to your economy, to your bureaucracy, to your even to your health service as well. So it's hugely risky in terms of decision making, and you better be able to rely on a plenty of data in terms of sample sizes.
Absolutely. Now, just on the Diamond Princess, Stanford professor John I can't even pronounce his name, I do apologize for that. He's showing that the lethality of COVID-19, based on the stats from that ship, he's estimating it between 0.025 and 0.625, in other words, in the range of a strong seasonal flu. Okay, so let's move on to this then. The United States, and this is the U.S. health weather map. And looking at the observed health of people in the United States, we're seeing that compared to the average, the observed illness levels are at low to mild. Now, this is quite interesting because, of course, this website put the usual caveat on this information. It said, note, due to widespread social distancing, school closures, stay-at-home orders, etc., feverish illness levels are dropping in many regions. This does not mean COVID-19 cases are declining. In fact, we expect to see reported cases continue to surge in the near term, but it may indicate these measures are starting to slow the spread. Well, yes, okay, that's a reasonable statement to make, perhaps, but the point is that in the US, Patrick, correct me if I'm wrong, you've only had these impositions imposed for a week. So that data that we see on screen at the moment, that statement doesn't apply to, because in fact that the measures weren't in place yet. Mm-hmm. So still in the United States, we're not seeing this big. I mean, the media is ramping up or implying that the measures are extremely, or that the numbers are extremely serious, but in fact, the data doesn't bear that out.
Well, just my comment on that, Mike, is that in crisis, mainstream media tends to rely on headline, really attention-grabbing headlines, emotive headlines. And so there's an over-focus right now, clearly, if you look at the U.S. media coverage. Infection rate. It's all about the infection rate. How many people have caught it? Well, obviously, they've ramped up testing. So, of course, the, quote, infection rate or the carrier rate is going to rise significantly, as it has in other countries like Germany and South Korea, when they've started ramping up testing. But of course, Mike, when you ramp up testing and you find out that actually more people have it or are carrying it, but the fatality rates aren't ramping up with the infection rate. So the case fatality rate, the death rate, drops significantly. And this is what the Stanford medical professors were also saying in their recent article in the Wall Street Journal. So now you get a clearer picture in terms of how coronavirus, COVID-19, compares with, let's say, for example, the seasonal flu in terms of case fatality rate. And what they're finding in some cases is that they're not much different, Mike. Mm. And so that should change the calculus of policymakers with that type of information. The question is, will it? Or will we continue with the current trajectory in terms of policy, which is increased lockdown measures, increased economic shutdowns and bailouts and so forth? And so, yeah, we're potentially heading down a risky path, according to some experts and pundits.
So here's the last one here. Virologist Guido Taro from Italy saying the death rate of COVID-19 is less than 1%, as confirmed by the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases. Now, this is in Italy. So he's saying that the higher values only arise because no distinction is made between deaths with and deaths by COVID-19. and because the number of symptom-free infected persons is greatly underestimated. So this is a common theme that's starting to appear through a lot of experts that are speaking out on this. It's not being reported by the mainstream press. And again, here he is very clearly making the distinction between people that have died with COVID-19 and people who have died because of COVID-19. And I'm just going to say again that if you look at most of the BBC reporting on this, they talk about with COVID-19, not of COVID-19. So the BBC not saying that people have died of this disease. Some of the other media a little less worried about the language that they use, but the BBC being quite correct about this. They're not making any kind of distinction in the way they're presenting the information, other than to be careful with their language. So you've got to read carefully what they say and understand what it is that they're saying.
So essentially what they're talking about in terms of the phenomenon here, Mike, is that you could die and then be tested post-mortem, and if they find that you're positive for coronavirus after you've died of pneumonia or some other respiratory illness or some other complication, that they are being marked down as coronavirus casualties.
Right.
And ditto if you're also not deceased, you're suffering from pneumonia or you're suffering from a major illness, you test positive for coronavirus. It doesn't necessarily mean that if you die or even if you got sick, according to many doctors, there's many different ways to trigger pneumonia. And because it is an autoimmune condition, Mike, effectively, according to all the medical journals. You can go ahead and Google that yourself. So that's where the confusion lies. Did it cause the death, or was it present when someone died? And that's for a doctor to determine.
Yes.
That's for a medical board to determine, a coroner's board. Is that sort of level of diligence being done? This is an important question.
I think it is not being done at this point. Now, of course, Imperial College, we've mentioned their studies that have been driving a lot of what the government has been doing over the last couple of weeks. Of course, they predicted 500,000, 600,000 deaths. Well, they are rolling back from that as quickly as they possibly can. Patrick, so I think we're down to 20,000 at this point. And then I just wanted to mention this because this is the editor of The Lancet, Richard Horton, which Guido Fox here making the point that there's a video of him doing the rounds at the moment from BBC Question Time where he's calling it a national scandal that Britain is in this position, saying that we knew in the last week of January that this was coming. The message from China was absolutely clear that a new virus with pandemic potential was hitting cities. So by making that statement, Patrick, he's justifying what's going on at the moment. But unfortunately for him, at the end of January, he tweeted this out, a call for caution, please. Media are escalating anxiety by talking of a killer virus and growing fears. In truth, from what we know, 2019 nCoV has moderate transmissibility and relatively low pathogenicity. There's no reason to foster panic with exaggerated language. So he can't have it both ways. I think that his narrative now is there to justify what the government is doing.
Well, there's two conversations he's having, Richard Horton, and they're both valid conversations. One's a political conversation, Mike.
Right.
And one is a scientific medical conversation. And his medical conversation is very compelling, Mike. And it does go against the sort of received wisdom of the day during this current panic and pandemic. So I do think Richard Horton probably has a strong medical case there early on, and maybe that should have been heeded. But the political case, that's a whole separate conversation.
Yes. Okay, well, look, let's have a look at what's going on in Eastern Europe then, Patrick. And we've headlined this Corona coup.
That's right. So this is in Albania. This is on the fringe of Europe, or let's say this is Europe. It's just across the sea from Italy. Coronavirus, 300 punished in Albania for violating national curfew. So this is a country that has gone into full martial law. They have gone into lockdown from March the 9th. So this is martial law from March the 9th. So this is full-blown martial law. Not allowed to leave the house, not allowed to drive, no movement whatsoever. They are now encountering some disruptions with food supply. distribution and bread shortages, Mike. Fights have been breaking out. We've been monitoring their press as well in the last week. We've also been speaking to local journalists about this story, and it's absolutely shocking what's going on. And I want to direct people, if they can, to 21st Century Wire. This is a interview we've had with a great Albanian journalist and university lecturer. His name is Olsi Gjezezi, and he's basically telling the story from his home of what's going on outside, and it is absolutely harrowing, Mike. And I do encourage people to go to 21st Century Wire, listen to this interview by Olsi. They're far ahead of Europe on the curve, but what's happened is the government leader has taken this advantage of this crisis in order to institute martial law. There is no parliament, there is no constitution, everything is effectively suspended, and people are being intimidated. And if you speak out against the policy, you're being labeled as a traitor, according to Olsi. So it's a shocking state of affairs. But let's take a look at closer at what's going on with Albania. And they've actually, Brussels has agreed to open a session talks with both Albania and Northern Macedonia. This is just this week, Mike. And if you recall, Mike, Emmanuel Macron delayed this because he said they weren't ready. Of course, he drew the anger of Donald Tusk and Jean-Claude Juncker at the time. But so there's some new people coming into the EU, and this is Olivier Verhey, and he is the Commissioner of EU Enlargement. And this is what he had to say. I wholly congratulate both countries. This also sends a loud and clear message to the Western Balkans. Your future is in the EU. And just to remind people, that is his title, Commissioner for EU Enlargement.
So what are you saying? The EU is using this coronavirus situation to drive EU enlargement?
I think they already were being more aggressive in terms of EU enlargement, Mike, especially after Brexit. So the imperative was there for Brussels. You know, we are shedding members. Mm. We need to bulk up in terms of our membership. So they're basically fast-tracking the applications or the discussions, let's say, of some of these states who are potential recruits. Let's look at some of the recruits, Mike, actually here. Let's look at some of the recruits. New recruits for the EU, of course, Albania. And we're going to add this little caveat. That's the flag of the MEK, the Mujahideen al-Kek, which Albanian government is hosting at the orders, really, of the United States and probably Tony Blair as well. This is a terrorist group that's meant to be overthrowing their, quote, regime in Tehran. They're being hosted in a large camp facility in Albania. And so that's interesting. So if Albania goes into the EU, Mike, they get the MEK as part of the deal. It's an added bonus.
Excellent.
A terrorist group. So Northern Macedonia, they're up as a new recruit. Also in line is Serbia, Montenegro, and also Turkey. And we're going to add a little ISIS, Al-Qaeda flag there as well, because that's part of the deal. You get buy one, get one. Buy one, get two with Turkey. You get Al-Qaeda and ISIS as part of the deal. So good job, EU. And Kosovo, we'll throw that in there too. They're also a hotbed of extremists, mostly being used and backed by Western powers, I might add. So Kosovo. Now, Kosovo is really important. Let me show you why. So now, Kosovo is an interesting case. This is what Olsi has pointed out. Actually, the Prime Minister of Kosovo, who's just been basically kicked out at the behest of the Americans, he's very anti-American in many ways. And so they've just helped another coronavirus coup d'etat in Kosovo, Prime Minister Albin Kurti. So will the Kosovars organize a Euromaidan-style revolution to bring him back to power? And this was the U.S. ambassador here of Kosovo, and his name is Philip Kosnet, and he's saying, please, to see the assembly, we'll hold a session on the no-confidence vote tomorrow. This was a few days ago. As I told the PM today, it is important for the assembly and all Kosovo institutions to respect the constitution. So that's effectively regime change. And Kurti, Mike, he didn't want to go along with U.S. advice for a full lockdown. Mm. This is what caused this crisis. This is why, hence the hashtag Corona Coup. So the U.S. is using this in order to eliminate some of the leaders that it doesn't like, or legislatures it doesn't like already. This is absolutely happening in Kosovo and also in Albania as well.
Okay, well, let's come back to the UK. And the job loss is starting to hit now. So in the construction industry, groundworks and civil engineering firms starting to lay people off. A lot of self-employed workers, 1,000 workers at M&J Evans, MV Kelly, hundreds there. Stoke-on-Trent, Caldwell Construction, 440 workers. Staffordshire Civils Contractor, Chasetown Construction, 130 workers, according to the Construction Enquirer. Then we had 1,500 to be, the Glasgow Council here were asking for 1,500 accept voluntary redundancy, but that has now been, the unions have basically pushed back against that, and they're saying that they don't want that to happen. Hampshire Council also redundancies, but there are calls to halt those too. And so the redundancy is starting to ramp up in this country. And as we mentioned on Wednesday's program, the queue for people who are applying for universal credit, just unbelievable. In one day, somebody was posting a screenshot saying 105,000 people in the queue ahead of you. So just unbelievable numbers of people in real trouble. Now, yesterday, the government announced support, they said, for the self-employed. But the practical reality of that is that support will not come through for weeks. It could even be a couple of months. And of course, on top of that, the level of support that people get is based on past tax returns. So if you've only been self-employed for a year, actually, it's very hard for an assessment to be made of what you're going to get from the government. So for people that have really only started in the last 12 months, that could result in them joining the queues for universal credit as well. So this is a pretty unpleasant situation for people. And the government doesn't seem to be managing this terribly well in getting people over the hump of the next 6 weeks or 2 months or 3 months in some cases. But just to give an idea of what's going on in the rest of Europe, here is Norway, and their unemployment rate is now over 10% due to coronavirus, according to Reuters. That's the highest since the 1930s. Now, you've been talking about the potential implications of the path that we are on here. Patrick, I'm going to go further. I think that enough damage has now already been done to economies right across the world that we are going to see huge numbers of unemployed. Norway, an example of this, and highest level since 1930s. This is going to be pretty unpleasant, and people need to be prepared for that. I think it's already too late unless there's some massive intervention to reverse that at this stage.
Absolutely. And just we'll look at the U.S. situation right now, Mike, and this just came out today. This is probably a very conservative estimate, but jobless claims soar past 3 million to record highs. And again, we're seeing reports of delays in terms of processing the applications and so forth. I've spoken to a number of people who have lost their job in the last 7 days. They've been laid off because of the economic reverberations of the federal government's decision to shut the country down effectively. So, Mike, and this brings up the point here. In just a few weeks, Main Street or the high streets have been destroyed. It's wiped out, no doubt about that. The working class have absolutely been wiped out. The middle class, in a matter of weeks, can be wiped out. It's a question of how long it takes to dissipate their savings. But the middle class, by the end of this crisis, if it drags on too long, will be wiped out. Small to medium-sized businesses destroyed. The self-employment sector destroyed. Okay, and the list goes on and on and on. And the reverberations of this are huge, not just economically, Mike, but socially. The cohesiveness of communities in terms of the high street, community culture, and how cities, towns, and communities are basically designed and interact, all of this has been severely damaged as a result of what's happened in the last 3 weeks, essentially. So can they recover, Mike? Will they recover, or will they ever be able to resume things as they were before? This is the question.
That's a very big question. What's been going on in New York then?
Well, let's look now from the federal level, Mike. Let's also look here at the state level. So the U.S. bailout bill, which we showed you earlier in the program, that's coming from the federal government, that $2 trillion bill. Mm-hmm. But here's a tweet here from a noted pollster in America, political scientist and pollster Richard Barris. He's saying, now New York's governor, Andrew Cuomo, is complaining that the federal government didn't bail out state budgets because New York is claiming it's now the epicenter of the COVID-19 crisis. So this is getting out of hand, he said. CARES Act had $250 billion, and governors are asking the feds to do their jobs on so many levels to cover their failures as state executives, from ventilators to budgets. Mm-hmm. So you can see what's brewing here, Mike. The problem is brewing here is that this isn't going to end with the federal budget. In the United States, and as you're seeing in Britain as well, Mike, local governments, regional authorities, they're also going to require bailouts as well. Okay, so there's the revenue streams have dried up, basically. So 50 states in the United States, and I'll just move on to what Richard Barris continues here. And he says, governors from both parties have allowed state budgets to become unrealistic and irresponsible. This is why numbers need to balance. So he's saying also that it was always an illusion. Budgets can't spend more than they bring in. Times like this, the worst of times to come, will be a reality check. And so here's the conundrum now. This is the conundrum, Mike, that if the federal government move in to basically cover all 50 states' budgets, and trust me, Mike, if one state claims federal relief on their state budget, everyone's going to want it. That's been the same with FEMA emergency funds and so forth. So everybody wants that federal money. They need it. They're desperate for it. So that's effectively going to bankrupt the federal government on one hand, but it's also going to give full federal control over all the states. That is a fundamental constitutional crisis in the United States. This has the potential to change the character of the U.S. As a constitutional republic. If the federal government doesn't bail them out, Mike, they risk that these states might go on their own, that potential fracturing of the union. This all depends on how long this crisis goes or how big the financial calamity is. What is the bottom of the barrel in terms of bailout checks, Mike? Is it $3 trillion? Is it $6 trillion? Is it $10 trillion? At the moment, we're going at $2 trillion per fortnight, Mike. Mm. It'll be another $2 trillion by the end of the month, and so forth and so on. When does it end? This is unsustainable. This could break the United States government and also fracture the union potentially, or it will become a full federalized, centralized, socialized federal government in the United States. I mean, this is historic right now.
Absolutely. So we'll just end with this one, Patrick, and that is the banks. And of course, one of the first things that the Boris Johnson government announced was £330 billion of loan guarantees to businesses in the UK. Well, is that going to work? I don't think so. And why not? Well, because they're only guaranteeing 80% of the loans. That means that what's actually happening is that the banks are beginning to say to business owners, well, actually, you've got to put your own assets on the line for this. You've got to sign a personal guarantee. Now, the banks claim that they are not going to go after people's main homes, but they are going to go after holiday homes or any other shares, cars, any other assets that you have in the event that your business goes out of business and you're not able to repay the loan. Now, the key thing here is that because the government is only offering an 80% guarantee on this, the banks will come for the 20% from you first before they go to the government for the rest. So
it's you personally guaranteeing the loan first, and then the government is behind you, right?
Right. And so many business owners, many MPs saying, well, why would a business owner whose business is at risk as a result of this political decision to lock the country down and to stop economies functioning, why would a business owner take that level of risk? It seems like a big ask.
It depends how desperate they are, Mike. And the other X factor here, Mike, is that this could be turned into a huge transfer of wealth in terms of transfer of assets, a la what we saw with the subprime mortgage crisis as well, where people are losing their homes, because they're not able to basically pay off loans, or they're in over their head in terms of debt. So on paper, the government is guaranteeing the loans, Mike, and that might look good if you're re-securitizing these debt packages and selling them on as derivatives. Is that going to happen? There's so many loans on the books. Are we going to see a reboot of what we saw in the subprime mortgage crisis with junk bonds and housing securities re-securitized, collateralized debt obligations and all of this stuff?
It has lots of financial potential.
There's a lot of paper being stacked up right now, but it's not guaranteed by the government, is it? It's guaranteed by you. You take the risk, not the government.
Absolutely. Sorry, we'll just end on this one then, Patrick, briefly.
Well, this was announced in the news the other day. Gordon Brown calls for a global government to tackle the coronavirus. So, of course, this is going to cause lots of clamoring in certain corners who have been warning about this for many years. Of course, Gordon Brown is a committed globalist, among other things, and he's now calling for a global government type structure in order to deal with this universal threat. Now, that might have seemed like a far-fetched conspiracy theory just a couple of years ago, but this week, Mike, here we are in March 2020, does that seem like a far-fetched possibility to you at this moment in time?
Well, apparently not.
Anything is possible.
Yeah.
Anything is possible. But people should take heed because behind Gordon Brown are some very powerful actors in financial institutions. Those are the circles he runs in. So I would pay very close attention to that.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, look, we're well over time, so we've got to leave it there. Thank you very much, Patrick, for joining us today. Thank you for joining us. We hope that despite everything that's going on, you have a great weekend. We'll be back at the same time as usual, 1 p.m. on Monday. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.